Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast is produced on Gadigal land.
At the time, everything was done in cash. So when we bought the first 10 acres of land, we needed to transact to this little old lady who lived in a tiny shanty house in Katuso Village with literally millions of shillings that we were providing to her in backpacks and wheelbarrows of just cash.
You're listening to Short Black with me, Sandra Sully. Good women, great chat. Well, what a pleasure it is for me at Short Black this morning to welcome Annabelle Chauncey, OAM, the founding director of School for Life. Now, you've been on our radar for some time, and what you've been doing at School for Life, it's 15 years young. Walk us through how it started and where you're at now.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for having me today. I started School for Life in 2008 after I travelled to Kenya and Uganda for the first time. I was halfway through my law degree and wanted to really use my law skills to be able to make a difference. And went to Kenya and Uganda and was just completely blown away by the number of children who don't have access to quality education, but also their desire to be educated and their desire to break themselves free from the cycle of poverty using education. So I came home resolved to do something to make a difference at the ripe age of 21 and teamed up with my co-founder, David Everett, and together we started School for Life.
Take me back to those early days, because we can see a need, but making it happen is a monumental Kilimanjaro effort, which is what you've achieved. But do you remember those early days about, you know, okay, wanting to make a difference, but how hard it was to actually make it a reality?
I think it's so interesting when you're driven by youthful passion and naivety.
Blind.
You don't even know what you're getting yourself into. Mm. So I think in some ways it was kind of just an idea on a piece of paper, but we really wanted it to happen. So we didn't really see the magnitude of the challenges that were going to be in front of us. And it became, I guess, a bit of a game of convincing as many people who would listen that we could make a difference and that they should get on board. So we were sort of persuading everybody that we could to be part of School for Life so that we could start the first classrooms, enroll the first students, hire the first teachers, and then ultimately that provided us with a bit of a track record to be able to build from. But I mean, you can imagine the amount of no's that we got, because we were two 21-year-olds who had half degrees finished, no credentials, no experience, had never built anything in our lives, and had then thought it'd be a great idea to go over to Africa to build something.
Yeah, sounds incredibly fanciful. but as you say, blind passion got you over the line. How did you convince those on the ground in Uganda that you were serious and you had a long-term vision and you could make it happen?
That was critical from the very beginning. And our vision was always to empower local people to help themselves. So we wanted to work side by side, shoulder to shoulder with local communities to give them both the capacity and the resources that they needed to be successful and sustainable for themselves. When we first entered Katuso Village, which was the community that we built our first school in, 3 or 4 years earlier, another Westerner had come into the community and promised that he was going to come back to build a school and never did. So we were on the back foot. We needed to build trust. And it was really critical that we mobilised the most, I guess, influential leaders in the community to get on board with the idea. And I think once we managed to kind of leverage those leaders and to work closely with the community around both the design and the execution of the program, then we started to get momentum.
I guess for me, seeing kids who have the world at their feet but not the skill set to achieve any dreams, you know, that would be indelibly inked on your brain. Any kids you're still in touch with from the early days, someone you formed a relationship with that you've never let go of, that really epitomises the whole journey for you?
Yeah, so our first enrolment was in 2011. and those students were in pre-primary and primary one, and they're going to be graduating at the end of next year. So Sissy is one of the young women who I met. At the time, her mum had said that she would be happy if Sissy went to year four at school so that she could learn to read and write so that she could then go and be married. And I remember just thinking, my gosh, can you imagine that being, I guess, your aspiration as a mother for your daughter, but equally that being what your world was going to look like? Sissy's now in senior five, which is year 11 equivalent, and she'll be graduating at the end of next year. She has aspirations to be a doctor, which I have no doubt she'll achieve. She has overcome so many obstacles. She's from an extremely disadvantaged family. Her healthcare was in poor form when she first came to School for Life. She has a number of sisters that she's had to look after during certain periods
of unrest.
Exactly. And then, you know, providing for a family, because at a very young age, children are often used as part of the family workforce. So they might have to grow the food that they used to eat. They might be fetching water after school or firewood to help to support the family homes. So she's overcome a huge amount of barriers, and I have no doubt that she'll become an incredible doctor.
You said you started in 2008, but the first student was 2011. So there's arguably a three-year gap.
Yes.
Where it was shoulder to the wheel, raising funds and convincing everyone that you were serious.
Definitely.
Who did you have to get over the line first?
So a few kind of critical pieces needed to fall into place. Firstly was to get a charitable registration, so setting up a company limited by guarantee. And part of that was ensuring that we had the right directors around us. Obviously, as custodians of the board, we needed to ensure that they both had good profile but equally could support us strategically. We then needed to get charitable licenses and fundraising licenses so that we could raise money. Once we had those, we would basically go out and ask anybody who would listen to support us. We were really lucky to get in a partnership with Rotary in the early days, and Rotary was really catalytic for us. The Rotarians are such incredible humans.
They are.
They have so many skills, but also time and a lot of resources that they use to give back. So that supported us. And then ultimately, when we were struggling to get that first cash injection, we decided to put on a black tie ball. I think we'd sold about 43 tickets 2 weeks before the ball itself.
And miraculously
managed to get Havaianas and Coca-Cola on board. And before we knew it, we'd sold 650 tickets. And on that night, we raised $100,000 when we told the whole audience that we were going to build a school in Uganda and we needed them to each buy a brick to be able to support us. So that was really the first black tie gala that we'd ever done, but equally the most impressive fundraising initiative that we'd done to date. And so we literally jumped on a plane that next day, went back, purchased land and started the construction with the local team.
But I can't imagine the minefield that you've had to traverse. I mean, can you speak the language?
No. So, I mean, it is Luganda. However, the majority of business is conducted in English and education is delivered in English as well. So that gave us great leverage.
And you are a lawyer, but you still had to purchase land.
I wasn't at the time.
No, sign contracts, be convinced that people were legit and you were going to get tradies and they were going to follow through with a commitment.
Yeah, and at the time, the majority of the transactions that we were doing were in cash because there was no such thing as electronic banking at the time. We were still on your Nokia brick phone. We didn't have the internet, so we were off in the jungle. Mum and Dad could have killed me. But again, it was all about people and relationships. You know, how can we really build strong relationships, both with people in Australia who were supporting us, but equally the people in Uganda and the community in which we were building the school?
Were there any financial hurdles early on, you know, technologically in terms of, you know, being able to fund an organisation on the other side of the world? What do you need to know to make that stuff happen? Because clearly you've got to be an expert.
Oh, I don't think expert. I would never classify myself as an expert. I think there were so many things we needed to work out. And part of that was just bank accounts in and of themselves. From the perspective of sending Australian dollars to Uganda, we needed to actually send them in US because Australian dollars don't go into Ugandan shillings directly. So working with Forex traders, making sure that we had bank accounts set up. And as I mentioned earlier, at the time, everything was done in cash. So when we bought the first 10 acres of land, we needed to transact to this little old lady who lived in a tiny shanty house in Katuso Village with literally millions of shillings that we were providing to her in backpacks and wheelbarrows of just cash. And then we just owned this 10-acre block of jungle, which we then somehow needed to figure out how do you turn this jungle into a school when there's no machinery. We didn't have any earth-moving machines. We didn't have, you know, everything had to be done by hand. So from hand digging the foundations right through to pressing and making the bricks on site, we had to kind of do all of that. And again, we had to employ people to do all of that. So we had to find a workforce and we had to figure out how we could communicate.
And obviously you got local advice, but then you'd be second guessing, surely, the bona fides of the people that are advising you, because life is littered with people who have other agendas.
Definitely.
So the checks and balances, you must have had your heart in your throat half that time.
I think so, but also we were really lucky. The High Commission of Uganda in Canberra helped us. So we had some support from a government perspective there, and they were also helping us with, you know, what lawyers do we use? What surveyors do we use? How do we set up bank accounts? What do we need to do in order to actually set up a charity in Uganda? So we did have a lot of different people kind of advising and supporting us. We didn't have to figure every single thing out from scratch.
When you look back, can you believe it's been 15 years?
In a weird way, yes, but equally no. We're now educating 1,700 students under the three schools that we run, and we've also now started outreach programs to the public government schools surrounding our schools. So we're sort of educating about 2,500 students. So in a weird way, I've been so focused on putting that next foot in front of the other that you kind of look back sometimes and go, oh, wow, look how far we've come.
How much help have you had from the federal government through this process?
In Australia?
Yeah.
We've had a few small grants.
But not enough.
Yeah, just through DFAT from the High Commission in Kenya. But largely, we have mostly been supported by individuals and philanthropists, which has been incredible.
Look, anyone who has an education knows it's the key to climbing a ladder out and up and across and over any obstacles that are around you. And you can almost not turn your back on where you come from, but it's the only way that you can get ahead. Clearly, as the beneficiary of a terrific education here in Australia, you and your friend Dave realised that education was the key, and you found many like-minded souls on the ground in Uganda. But then you had to come home and tell your parents about this idea. What sort of reception did you get when you came back?
I grew up in a relatively conservative family. So my dad's a sheep and cattle farmer. My mum's a teacher. She actually was my teacher the whole way through school. So I went to a very small primary school, had just 26 students in my whole school. Mum was my teacher. And then when I went on to go to boarding school at Frensham in the Southern Highlands, Mum ended up getting a job there as well. So I'd been, I guess, living in quite rural, relatively small communities. And then I came home and told Mum and Dad that I was going to build schools in Africa, which was obviously quite shocking and scary, which as a parent now, I'd probably be quite afraid as well. And I think, you know, everything you hear about Africa is negative in the media. You look at starvation, poverty, disease, war, famine, you know, everything that can go wrong seems to. And so I think they were right in having reservations, but equally, they also believed in me, and they were the ones who had empowered me with education. So they recognised that I could use my education to make a difference. So ultimately, we're very supportive.
Well, you've already ticked the box in Superstar just in terms of giving back and achieving so much. You said that you educate now 1,700 students, if not 2,500 with the schools. What does School for Life look like now, aside from the number of students you've got? I mean, you must be employing locals on the ground, training them up.
Yeah, we have 120 staff employed full-time locally. So that's in any range of different roles, from cooks and cleaners, security workers, labourers and construction workers, right through to the teachers. We have about 25-to-1 student-teacher ratio. We've got a large teacher workforce, about 75 teachers, and then we have the management team that supports. And then here in Australia, we employ 7 people. So we're quite large. We've also got a new start over in Kenya as our global program manager, and we've just started to develop our footprint in the UK as well. So we're becoming a more global business, which is really exciting.
So what are you hoping to achieve with the UK arm? Really to direct more funds and build your operations on the ground in Africa?
That's right. So there's a huge appetite for giving to Africa in the UK. So we've just decided that we'll test that market. Obviously, the cost of living here in Australia is impacting fundraising, so we're just trying to diversify our fundraising.
Let's talk about philanthropy in Australia. Some would argue it's not second nature for us as a nation, and internationally it is more so in some countries. How hard have you found it to actually raise money and get people to commit?
I think I'd tend to disagree with the fact that we're not charitable, to be honest. I feel like the communities that I grew up in were literally the backbone of the foundation of School for Life. I grew up in the Southern Highlands. We hosted a number of different events there. We've got a huge supporter base that are sponsoring children that have come to Black Tie Gala Balls that are really, really getting behind the work that we do. In the corporate world, lots of different corporates, particularly in the SME space, that have supported School for Life. And I think overall, people, if a cause resonates with them or your story resonates with them, they do dig deep. So my experience has been very positive around Australians wanting to do something to give back and feeling like they can tangibly make a difference through School for Life because of just how far the dollar goes over there.
Yeah, I think on an individual level, Australians are extremely charitable, but philanthropy takes it to another level, whether it's corporate or high net worth individuals, getting them to believe your bona fides and hand over the dollars. Listen, the journey hasn't been straightforward. There's been a few setbacks and an interesting moment when you were in Kenya. Tell us about that.
That was early days, actually, and that's how I landed in Uganda. In 2007, I was teaching English to children in a community in Kenya. And we were there over the Christmas New Year period, which is when there was an election, and it was an incredibly turbulent time. There was huge amounts of civil unrest. Before I knew it, you know, neighbours were turning on neighbours. There was a lot of tribal conflict, and we were evacuated across the border into Uganda. At the time, we were 21. We left everything that we had brought over there because we thought we'd be back in a few weeks. But unfortunately, the uprising just never settled, and we never went back to Kenya, which is how I started working in Uganda, and I think felt to some degree that Uganda had more need than Kenya did.
People get concerned about the safety on the ground in Uganda. How many times do you think you've been there since 2007?
Oh, I think on average 4 times a year for the last 15 years.
So what do you say to Australians who hesitate about signing up for a trip?
Oh, I think things can go wrong anywhere. I think at the end of the day, the people are the most generous, kind, incredible people I've ever met. I do a lot, if not everything, on my own over there and have never run into any problems. I think go for it. I mean, Uganda is a spectacular place. It's got the source of the Nile. You know, you can go and see the mountain gorillas. It's really amazing. But I think above all, Africa just has this incredible heartbeat, this colour, this richness, this sense of family and community that you don't necessarily experience here in Australia. You get onto a bus, a public transport bus, and literally by the end of the bus ride, you know everybody's name, how many children they have, what they do for work. Everybody just chats to each other. It's beautiful.
You've achieved so much, but you know, you must pinch yourself at times and think, wow, I've actually got here and I'm in one piece and I'm making a difference. But anyone I speak to who's successful in their own right has always suffered doubt and insecurity. Did you along the way?
Yeah, I mean, every week. I think that's the reality, is you suffer from things like imposter syndrome as the business grows. You know, are you the right person to lead it forward? Do I have the right skills? Do I have what it takes to take the organization to the next level? There's been times where the funding hasn't been easy to raise and you think, oh my gosh, can I keep doing this? Do people even care? How can I convince people to care? So you do, you get overwhelmed with different doubts and insecurities. And I think particularly as a female in business, I think we are quite hard on ourselves. We're quite self-critical. We really question and think about some of the decisions that we make and reflect a lot on how we could have perhaps done things better or differently.
When you do that, what would you have changed when you look back now?
Yeah, it's so interesting in this weird way, because of that youthful naivety, I wouldn't change too much because I think that was such a strength at the time. But I mean, things like we were bootstrapping. I mean, we literally were running on the smell of an oily rag and, you know, working around the clock. I think some of the very small things I would change would be I would probably inject a little bit more capital into the operations of the business earlier. It took us a long time to pay a workforce. And I think part of that is because people believe just because you're a charity, you shouldn't pay people. But I do believe that you get back tenfold what you pay. And so building an aligned and really, really motivated team has been critical to us and our growth along the journey.
And it's not just bricks and mortar and teachers, but when I look through the sorts of work you do on the ground, you've got healthcare days, you're providing menstrual hygiene kits to women and girls, 3 nutritious meals a day for all staff and students. At what point did you realise it needed to be a wholesale package? Mm. Otherwise, arguably, the students, even if they did turn up and they weren't fed, they couldn't concentrate.
That's it. And that was what was so interesting about the lived experience. The day we opened the doors of the schools, the kids came to school and they literally had never done up buttons on a shirt. They'd never tied up shoelaces on shoes because they'd never owned shirts or shoes before. And then quite quickly what we realised was that they were falling asleep at their desks, not because they weren't interested in class, but because they were starving. And most of them were only eating one meal a day and they were coming to school and they were exhausted. So we started to realise by nature of their vulnerability that we needed to actually create a more holistic intervention, make sure that their healthcare was being looked after, because periodically they would miss weeks on end of school because they'd get things like malaria, which are treatable diseases, gastro, respiratory illnesses, all sorts of different very treatable illnesses, which is why we started the health clinics. And in fact, 6 of our builders came down with typhoid in the first 3 weeks of construction because they were fetching water from contaminated puddles on the ground.
Mm.
There was no clean water sources within the entire community. So putting in deep set boreholes where we could give the whole community access to free, clean drinking water was a really, really catalytic thing to do. So it just sort of started evolving, I guess, and then that's how it became so holistic as we realised the needs.
The population of Uganda is just past 49 million. What percentage of kids there would you say have access to education at the very least?
Statistically, I think 1 in 3 children completes primary education and 17% complete high school. It's crazy how few students are actually getting access to the system. And that's mostly because the GDP just doesn't support the amount of children and the growth of the population. The challenge also is not just access, but also quality, because once the students get to school, often the teacher doesn't have the skills to be teaching the class, or they don't have any resources to teach the class. So they might not have textbooks or a blackboard or anything that they can use. The kids are sitting on the floor in a mud hut. So it's a really, really challenging environment to educate students in. But yeah, we're doing what we can to make a difference.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Clearly, to maintain the successful journey that you've been on, I note your board of directors, and it's a pretty impressive group. You've got lawyers, the head of risk at ANZ. You've got Dr. Bryony Scott, who is the principal at Winona, a prestigious girls' school in New South Wales. How did you manage to convene such an impressive board to get on board with School for Life? And what support do they provide you as you continue to work on this path?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think in terms of convincing them to get involved, that was more on a one-to-one basis. And we obviously have a skills matrix in place. So we look for a range of different people and different who have different skills to bring to the board. All of them are so impressive in their own right. And then when you put them together in a room, you can have some really hearty conversations. I think people like Bryony Scott bring an immense amount of perspective to education itself. She's obviously a very innovative education leader here in Australia, and so she brings a fresh mind to complex problems, and they help us as we particularly develop strategy for how are we going to overcome the next hurdle, be that from a programmatic side with education or from a fundraising side with strategy for creating different revenue channels.
It's hard to get your head around this 15-year journey and where you've landed. Now you're spreading to the UK. If people want to help, how can they?
They can jump online via our website at schoolforlife.org.au. You can obviously sponsor a child or make a donation there.
What percentage of any funds that you donate actually go to the program, as opposed to people have reservations about donations being absorbed into admin? Have you got a percentage breakdown?
Yeah, I think 4% goes to admin. We're very, very low overheads. We make sure that we get as much of the dollar to the ground, obviously with a recognition that we do need to have some administrative support to ensure that we can keep the wheels turning here in Australia.
There's always something you really need. For those listening today who can help, give me the top three things you really want right now.
Definitely support for the Child Sponsorship Program. Our numbers of students grow every year, year on year, and we've forever got a gap of the students that need to be sponsored versus the students that are.
What does that sponsorship in a dollar amount look like?
It's $52 a month, which is pretty, you know, I mean, that is kind of less than a coffee a day. Well, especially at the moment, I think a coffee is about $5.
Is it tax deductible?
It is absolutely tax deductible.
$52 a month can change the life of a young...
Forever. Providing three nutritious meals, access to healthcare, clean drinking water, teachers, books, uniforms, everything they need to survive and thrive. Outside of that, we are constantly looking for support for infrastructure. So we're constantly doing different infrastructure. At the moment, we run a boarding facility for 600 students, 400 of whom are female. So we're growing our boarding space. So things like beds, mattresses, access to bathrooms, water tanks, all of the facilities that we need to keep the kids safe and healthy. And then outside of that, we'd always be looking for support with our government outreach programs, which is essentially us being able to increase our footprint by providing more access to things like capacity development programs, infrastructure, books, teaching resources, and of course, food for the students as well.
Clearly, you're someone that dreams big and you haven't stopped. What's your big dream for School for Life in 15 years' time?
We're just working on the next iteration. So now that we've proven the model, we're working with some of the most vulnerable children in Uganda. We're just about to expand into refugee communities. So we're looking at a partnership with a number of different local founders who are providing education in that space. We're particularly passionate about refugee education because for very many of them, they're provided with basic human needs, like maybe one meal a day, but there's no opportunity for growth. So things like education are not provided within refugee camps. And it's just like, what are these children going to go on to do? Very many of them have been in these camps for a huge period of time, even growing up there, being born into the camps. And so we think we can make an impact in the refugee space next. And then ultimately, we've got a vision of trying to grow our impact into different areas of sub-Saharan Africa.
When I think about someone like Sissy, who you mentioned earlier, and she's your first graduate and arguably your baby of this entire program, when she graduates and you said she wants to be a doctor, what are the next real hurdles she faces in trying to get to university?
That's also something that we're working on strategically at the moment. So we will be providing some of our students' pathways education options to tertiary. So, for example, there's a fantastic university in Kampala in Uganda. We'd be looking to support her with a scholarship or also facilitate her to be able to get the sort of HECS-based system of funding support from the Ugandan government to be able to support her with her next education step. We're also running a concurrent program, which is to channel students into vocational training pathways, because as you can imagine, for a lot of them, skilling is a really, really lucrative opportunity for employment. So things like carpentry, hairdressing, construction work, all sorts of different vocations, even nursing and teaching are part of that portfolio, so that we can ensure that they're actually going to be employable after they exit the School for Life system.
Clearly, you're making a difference on the ground in Uganda. What sort of reception do you get when you land? Can you pick up the phone at any time to key ministers and make things happen? And what does that feel like for someone who started with just a big dream?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, we've tried to build the local capacity. So I would hope that I'm not the front face over there. It's critical to me that I'm not. You know, we have such an amazing team, particularly of women leaders over there, which is so inspiring, particularly for the students to see. Women are often kind of used for domestic labour and childbearing rather than actually seen as leaders and the next, you know, generation. So it's really amazing to see my country director, a director of programs, as females who are inspiring the next generation of young women to dream big and to think about what's next. And they're the ones who can pick up the phone to the government and make some of the recommendations or seek the support that they need.
Now, you're the mum of one with another on the way. Who's Annabel Chauncey when she's not running School for Life?
I'm a country girl at heart, and I've moved back down to the Southern Highlands to be near my family. So we live on 2 acres out there, and I love my running when I'm not pregnant. I chase after my two-year-old daughter, Charlotte, who's just the light of my life. And yeah, really just incredibly family-driven. I just love being around my family and am just enjoying, I guess, being able to have the ability to raise a family outside of Sydney, which is really important to me, similarly to how I grew up.
And I guess with technology these days, it's actually relatively straightforward running this organisation in Uganda from the Southern Highlands of New South Wales.
I never dreamed it would be possible. I think COVID, whilst it was a challenge, I think it's got some real benefits that have been attached to it. I still come to Sydney a couple of days a week, but it's just enabled us to have a very different life to what we originally thought we were going to have.
Some advice today on other entrepreneurs who want to dream big and make a difference and give back. What would be, say, the top 5 tips?
Dream big and don't let the naysayers and the critics get in the way. We certainly had a lot of people who said no to us and said, come back to us when you've got your degree, or come back to us when you're older, or don't come back to us at all. Continue to fight the good fight, even when the going gets tough. I also found this quote really helpful. Anything is possible, but everything isn't. And I think that's really critical, because being really clear on your vision will enable you to be really quite focused on what you need to do to get there. And I think often problems can seem so huge that you feel like you need to do everything to fix them, but actually you just need to be really, really clear about where you can add the most impact. And I think also just go for it. I think, you know, you can sit and you can strategize, you can spend forever writing out business plans. But until you take that first step, that's when you start to learn. And it's always an evolution. You know, you never get everything right, no matter how much you plan for it. You're forever having to deal with the hurdles. So just go for it.
I look back and there isn't an award you really haven't achieved. And I know plenty of others who may be starting out on a journey similar to yours in whatever field that they're passionate about. How important is it to chase this sort of award and recognition in terms of building trust, really, and building your brand, ensuring that, for example, you nail this board of influential people that back you?
Yeah, I think critical. I think it's given me a platform to share School for Life's story. It's also added a lot of credential to the work that we do. And so whilst it doesn't always feel comfortable to put yourself out there and up for these awards or winning awards, and it might not necessarily be core to the purpose of why you've started something, they do provide you with an incredible opportunity both to meet wonderful people, but also to tell your story and to share it with people who can ultimately open doors and help to share your story elsewhere.
Have you had the chance to take any of your family over to see your work?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Dad, I think, passed out when he went there the first time. He was crying. He couldn't believe it. And my brothers have been across. So my husband, that's how we met. So lots of family. I think School for Life is very much part of the fabric of our family these days as well.
You met your husband over there. How did that happen?
My husband actually signed up as a skilled volunteer to upskill our foreman on construction site.
And you went, hey, good looking.
Exactly. And he was over there for 4 months working side by side with our construction team. And then when he came back, yeah, we got together.
I guess there's no arguments at the table about, you know, it's your dream.
No, definitely not. And I honestly, he's fixed so many problems for me. I don't know what I'd do without him, particularly with all of the construction works. We ended up building our first school without any guttering, which is a crazy mistake to make in a place like Africa where the rainfall is absolutely huge, yet there's no access to clean water. So he went back and reverse engineered all the guttering onto the schools so that we could have 1 million litres of fresh, clean drinking water being captured into tanks.
So you just got to surround yourself with clever people.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or marry them.
Exactly.
Well, Annabel Chauncey, OAM, you are an exceptional human being, and we're so grateful that you've spent some time with us here at Short Black. We love everything that you do at School for Life. Again, let us know if there's any other way we can help spread your story, because we just want to see you continue to spread the love, educate these young men and women in Uganda, and build more schools for life around the world. Onwards and upwards for you, Annabel Chauncey, OAM, and thanks so much for spending some time with us here at Short Black.
Thank you for having me, Sandra. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to Short Black, a Network 10 podcast. To make sure you don't miss any episodes, subscribe in your favourite podcast app. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.